Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk podcast. We help you build a thriving creative career. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza! You can stay up to date with all things Creative Pep Talk by following me on Instagram at Andy J. Pizza. Let's get into today's episode. This episode is supported by In the Making, an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express, the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. If you are trying to boost the YouTube, TikTok, Reels content side of what you're doing, one episode of In the Making that I think will be super useful to you is their episode with John Yushai. I think John's method for including his audience in the process is really inspiring. And if you want to hear about that and more about leveling up your game in the creator economy, just search In the Making in your podcast player to listen. Many thanks to In the Making and Adobe Express for their support. I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it, got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. Today on the show, we have the third appearance of my friend and creative superstar, Lisa Congdon. This episode is straight fire. We talk about how to find your artistic voice, because Lisa has a new book out called Find Your Artistic Voice, in which I play a very small role, one of the interviews in the book. The book is fantastic. It's beautiful. I think it's an easy thing to devour, and I think it has potential to massively impact your ability to get in touch with your creative voice. I want to talk about that more in a second, but before I do, I gotta let you know, yesterday marked the 5-year anniversary of this podcast. 5 years ago, October 14th, I launched the first episode of Creative Pep Talk. And I'm actually getting emotional right now, which feels silly. I didn't plan what to say for this because I just wanted it to come from my heart. And I don't know what to say other than thank you. I will say one thing, showing up week after week, trying to create a podcast and some podcast artwork has had such a dramatic impact on me that I never expected. When I made this podcast, I was a full-time illustrator, and my intention was to have an impact on you. Never in my wildest dreams did I think the podcast was going to have such a wild impact on me on a personal level. Making this much work, saying this much stuff in my creative work had such a profound impact on me. And I never saw that coming. It changed how I saw myself. It got me in touch. It excavated so much of my internal world that I didn't even know was there. And I think that it's fitting that this would be the episode that we would do 5 years into the show, because I think nothing more than this podcast has got me in touch with my creative voice. I love this quote by Epictetus that says, "You can't learn what you think you already know." And when you try to create work in your voice, then you don't give yourself the chance to find it, because to try to create it in your voice is to assume that you already know what it is, instead of looking, you know, searching your insides with the creative work, instead of seeing your creative work as an expression of your voice, see it as a tool for excavation. Because if you think you already have it, you'll never find it. If you show up and make from the place of, what am I going to learn next about my voice? What am I going to find inside of me that I didn't know was there? If you always start with that mindset of a beginner and never believe that you arrive, you will live more and more into your creative voice over time. And I think this conversation with my friend Lisa is the perfect icing of the cake of 5 years of Creative Pep Talk, because it gets to the heart of so many of the core values of this show. Lisa is a huge inspiration to me. There's not many people I know, I don't have many friends that are as self-actualized as she is and as in tune with their creative voice as she is. She's a constant inspiration to me. I couldn't be more happier to celebrate 5 years of the show than with a chat that I had with her. And this talk is so good. I can't wait to share it with you. Why do I keep talking? Let's just get to it. Here she is, Lisa Congdon. You think it's okay?
I think you're totally fine.
Okay.
You're just being too mellow.
All right. I gotta get. Woo! Let's do it. Yeah, all right. Yeah, look, there's the stuff. Thanks, man. Hey. Thanks for getting me out of my shell.
The non-technological solution. Yeah. Just bring up your energy.
Yeah. All right. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for doing this.
Of course.
I'm glad that you're here in my
room. Yes, we are together.
Yeah, it's so much better that way. And we're doing our event tonight.
I'm
super pumped about.
Yeah,
and we're celebrating your book.
Thank you for bringing me here to celebrate my book.
Yeah, I have plenty of good questions, hopefully, for you. And I wanted to kick it off with hopefully a simple question, but it's, why did you write this book? Why did you write Find Your Artistic Voice?
Well, there's sort of a practical answer, and then there's the sort of deeper answer. So actually, a few years ago, I did a survey. I think it was on Instagram, and it might have even had some like Google Doc attached to it so my followers could fill out the survey. Mm-hmm. But it was basically like, what do you want to learn from me? And one of the top things that came up was finding your style. Not necessarily finding your voice, but some iteration of that question came up a lot. And so initially, I wasn't thinking of it in terms of like, what book do I want to write, but more potentially a class or a blog post. Mm. So I wrote a blog post that was like 2 pages from this book, or the equivalent of that.
What, 2 pages less? Like it was huge?
Like, no.
Oh.
No, meaning like
2 actual pages.
It was so condensed. And I really understood at that moment that I didn't really know what I was talking about. Mm. Not that I don't have anything to say about finding your artistic voice, because, you know, I obviously do. But like, I realized I had a lot to learn. So simultaneously, my editor read that blog post and said, I don't think this is a blog post. I think this is a book. And I was like, do you really think I have 30,000 words to say about this topic? And she's like, I do. Why don't you come up with a proposal? So that's a sort of practical answer. The deeper answer is that I am somebody who reflects a lot on my own journey. Like sometimes I wake up in the morning and I'm like, how did I get here?
Yeah.
Like, 10 years ago.
Like when you wake up in an alley and.
Right. Exactly.
How did I
get here? And you know, cause 20 years ago I like took my first art class, and I was like most people who take their first art class. you know, I was a, very much a beginner. I thought of the journey that I was on at the time was more sort of self-discovery. I had gone through a breakup of a major relationship. I left my job to left my job as a teacher to go work at a nonprofit organization. So I wasn't, you know, that was a big shift. And so I was sort of like in this place where I was trying to figure out who I was, and I discovered art in the process, but I never imagined it would be my career.
Yeah.
Lots of things unfolded that sort of, you know, made it my career years later. But I often think, like, how did I go from this person who actually never as a child or even a teenager had very much interest in being a creative person or making art? I wasn't one of those nerdy art kids.
Yeah.
I was actually the kid who was like playing outside with all of the other kids. You know, I was definitely creative in my make believe and all of that, but I wasn't necessarily like holed up in my room drawing in my sketchbook.
Yeah.
So I never was pinned as like the creative kid. And so really for the first time I was exploring this part of myself, and it unleashed something in me that was that I couldn't contain. And so eventually it became my professional life as well. I went, you know, from being this total beginner to over 20 years, having a fully formed voice and having this really thriving professional career. So it's actually the topic of finding your voice is super interesting to me just on a personal level. Like, yeah. How did that happen for me when I didn't go to art school? I didn't study art. Like, sort of, I'm very much a self-taught person. I definitely took advantage of the internet, but, you know, how did I get here? And so I started to unpack that. I also was super interested in creativity as a topic. Like, what does the research say about how the creative brain works, and how does that play into finding your voice? And I also was interested in what other people had to say. So the book is filled with interviews. There's 10 interviews with 11 people, because one of them is with two people who work together on projects. And what do they have to say about voice, and how is that the same as or different from the way I've thought about it? So I spent a couple of years just researching, writing, exploring, interviewing, and came up with some conclusions that then became the book.
Yeah. So I want to run back to something you said at the start and then go into the kind of deeper philosophical stuff. At the start, you were talking about how this thing was a blog before it was anything else. And also, so I'm very interested in this idea. I've kind of pushed hardcore against the classic creative notion that you shouldn't listen to your audience. You shouldn't. And now it's a nuanced thing that I'm saying, and I could, believe me, I've hours online trying to explain what I mean by that. But I find it really interesting that this book that is fantastic, it's doing super well.
It's on its fifth printing.
Yeah.
It's only been out for a month and a half.
I find it super interesting that it started with a survey from your audience. And then also a blog post. And I feel like there's a lot to be said about how to approach listening to your audience, how to also approach, you know, what I call writing on stage, which is what comedians do, which is instead of, you know, going into a cabin and writing their comedy set, they write it on stage over time. They workshop it on stage and they get that feedback loop, and it informs what they do. And I think that I'm just curious how you feel about those things, like one, listening to your audience, how that informs your work and how it informed this book. And then on top of that, also how you kind of create publicly instead, like another thing that creative people do is they have all these ideas, but they keep them to themselves. They don't make a blog post. You know, they don't talk about it to their audience. They try to, and usually it just doesn't turn into anything because they're just holding on to it. They're two different topics, but I wanted to explore both. First one is listening to your audience. How has that, what's your relationship to that? How have you found it to be a healthy thing for your career? Does that make sense as a question?
And a lot of people ask me, I mean, one of the most, this is a very simplistic way to ask the same question.
Yeah.
But a lot of people will say,
please put it in a nutshell for me.
Do you make art for Instagram, for example, right. is what some people will say.
Yeah.
And so, or how do you deal with the pressure of feeling like you're making work for an audience? And so the first thing I say is I wouldn't have a career without my audience.
Totally.
Because I came into this at a time when, the internet was the place where I could actually build a career. So it was dependent on finding my audience. And part of finding your voice is I don't talk about it explicitly in the book because this is less about having a that book is less about having a professional career and more about sort of like finding your artistic voice. But certainly in a professional, from a professional perspective, finding who, what I'm about as an artist has helped me find people who are either about the same thing or want to consume what I, and I don't necessarily mean monetarily only.
Yeah,
I just mean
they want to experience
They want to experience it. So that process was super important to me. And so I talk a lot about things in terms of Venn diagrams.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be one in my talk tonight.
Yeah.
And so I make all kinds of Venn diagrams that try to explain how I feel about things. Cause it's never just one thing, right? Like it's like the merging of things. And I haven't made a Venn diagram about this in particular thing, but I probably should. But in my head, there's this Venn diagram where one of the circles is, you know, what I love to do or what I love to make or the issues or that are important to me or what I want to make work about that comes from my own experience or, you know, about things that I value.
Yeah.
And then another one of the circles is, what my audience finds interesting.
Yeah.
And so I'm constantly trying to figure out where those two things overlap. And there's probably a couple other circles that need to overlap also.
Sure.
I don't want to oversimplify it or overexplain it, but I'm trying to always find the sweet spot between what's interesting to me, what I'm passionate about, what I want to make work about, and what other people are interested in hearing from me. And I actually enjoy that process.
Me too.
I don't find it selling out. I don't find it minimizing. I certainly am very vocal about things that a lot of people disagree with. So,
sure.
So it's not like I'm trying to pander to everyone. I'm just trying to figure out like, what are the things that, you know, and so part of, actually when I did that survey was sort of in the beginning of me really sort of figuring out that that's how Instagram was working for me. And so, that survey was sort of part of that. And it wasn't necessarily like how I'm going to structure what I post every day for my audience. It was more like, what books or classes or, you know, blog posts do I want to write that where people can learn from me? Because I feel like I feel part of my value system is, you know, my career was built on the generosity of people who or on the backs of people who came before me. And I feel an obligation and a joy actually in giving that back to other people. And so part of it also for me is like this sense of service that I have. So maybe that's another circle in my Venn diagram, right? Like, that I have some sense of wanting to give back. And, so it feels good to me. And I think that that's what most people struggle with is like figuring out a formula for them, for their online presence, which is, let's face it, how you promote yourself as an artist and sustain your career these days. Figuring out a formula that feels good to them. And feels authentic. I hate that word because it gets overused, but you know what I mean.
Lost like, its saltiness, but yes.
Yeah. And that people will see me post one of my Venn diagrams and they'll say, can I get a print of this? And I said, no, because that's my Venn diagram.
Right.
You go make your own.
Yeah.
Because it is it might look similar to mine,
sure.
But like really this is about what you want to figure out for yourself. And so I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh, it's so good. I love it. I wrote like 8 notes. So, okay, one of the things you said that I find really interesting is the people that, look, I think, you know, you don't have to make art as a career. That you can make art and it's not a career, and that's great. But if you want to make a career, it seems to me that the people that are interested in art as a service to humanity, not necessarily like goods and services, but kind of a little bit that, this idea of, I think tapping into the notion that we're like social animals we're inextricably linked. Like our happiness is linked to serving and help. And, you know, that's like an evolutionary thing. And you mentioned the word service of like, serving your audience. Like there you find joy and peace and fulfillment from showing up and providing something for them. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. And what, okay. So that leads me to the next question of, you also said something I've been thinking a lot about, and in a short list of maybe 10 people, you're one of these people I've been thinking about. Part of the reason I think you are so loved by your audience is that they know what you're about. And I told you last night, I've been thinking about the difference between a bad artist and a good artist is probably craft and skill, stuff like that, taste. But then from good to great, I think it has more to do with they're in touch with their values and they know what they're about. That's the exact same word I used that you just said, is that you know what you're about. Because it sounds like you're saying what you're about influences and impacts and informs your artistic voice.
Yes.
How did you figure that out? Because I feel like, obviously it's not a destination, it's a journey, you're always going to be learning, but you seem to be very self-actualized. And it's something I respect about you, and I'm very inspired by, you know a lot of things that you're about. You might not know at all, but you do. How did that come about? Was it through making stuff?
Well, yes, but also you have to remember that I didn't even pick up a paintbrush until I was like 32 years old.
Yes.
I say 31 or 32 because I can't exactly remember.
Sure.
And I'm 50, I almost said 52. I'm not 52 yet. I'm 51 right now. So for 20 years I've been, I had already lived 32 years, right? Which is actually beyond when most people start making art. So by the time I started my art career when I was 39, and then by the time I sort of had a visible presence on social media when I was in my 40s, I had had a lot of life experience, both doing other things and in making art, and years of therapy, years of understanding sort of the role of politics in my own life, and privilege and all of those things, right? Like, and I had a lot of time to reflect on those. And I think, you know, a lot of people get scared that they're too old, right?
Right.
Or, you know, like I'm sort of a role model for women in particular who are embarking on a career after 40 or starting something new later in life, right? And, but I always tell those people, like, you bring so much wisdom and you know who you are in a way that I didn't know who I was in my 20s or even into my 30s. So I think part of that, what you describe as self-actualization, is actually just the accumulation of years of lived experience. Mm. And I have this perspective, like, I still freak out, I still have anxiety, all those things. But I also have this perspective that calms me down pretty quickly, which is like, I've gotten through a million hard things before, I'll get through this, or I'm really scared right now, but I know nothing terrible is going to happen if I put this out into the world, or you know. So I think that's also part of it. And I think some of it too is just part of being online is this sort of scary thing for a lot of people to sort of like take a stand on anything, even if it's something that seems really banal or undisputable.
Yeah.
Like love as a topic, or, you know, and yet people are terrified to take a stand on anything because we live in this very divided, you know, that's just sort of, people are afraid of, you know, expressing their values.
Yeah.
And I am totally human too. So when I first started using my platform and my art to sort of like talk about topics that were, some of them not even controversial, but like more vulnerable for me to talk about, I was also terrified. But the more I did it, the more I realized that my connection with my audience grew, as opposed to the opposite, which is what I was terrified, that I was going to alienate people, or that people were going to think I was a weirdo or whatever. And so I learned through being vulnerable that that was like the basis for connection with my audience. And as you say, you know, I have a following that is really a loving following for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, I have some questioners, and I'm sure people who are on the fence about me and what I stand for, and that's totally fine. And
yeah.
But, you know, for the most part, I have this really devoted following. And part of that is not that I'm some sort of guru, but that because I don't want to be that at all to people. In fact, sure. Most of the time I'm talking about what I don't know and what I'm still trying to figure out myself.
Yep.
Versus like, this is, you know, how you should be, and this is how I live my life or whatever. I think people find some sort of like comfort in that and connection in that. And it's such a gratifying thing. And also, to your point earlier, like, I talk a lot about like creativity is power, right? And it's important to use it for good. And I began to understand that the stuff I was making was impacting people's lives, and that I wanted to do more of that. And so part of showing up online for me, or making work for an audience, is making work for an audience that maybe even challenges the way people think about things. It's actually, I think some of the stuff I talk about is challenging for people. Mm-hmm. It's actually somewhat controversial. And I don't even mean my political posts. I mean, sure. Like, just, you know, and that's part of why people show up also, is that they're not just hearing like wispy feel good quotations. They're hearing ideas that challenge the way they've thought about themselves or their boundaries or, you know, other things.
Yeah. That it reminds me also, when you're talking about age, one of the things that was really frustrating to me when I was in my 20s or in college, and I didn't realize why I was frustrated by it, but we'd have visiting artists, or we'd have our teachers tell us, you just need to be yourself in the work. And at the time, I didn't know why that was driving me nuts. But then now I see that I don't know who I am.
Yeah.
How can I be?
That's myself? Why it drove you nuts. Yes. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and that clearly is an advantage for people that have gone, you know, been here longer.
Exactly. Yeah. Part of my talk tonight is this just tiny little blip about, I think, you know, like, when I first started making art, basically your voice is your story. One aspect of your voice is your story. And so when I started making art, like, or until I started making art, I thought I had no story. I thought it was just like this boring, you know, upper middle class white girl who had nothing important to say. And the minute I started creating, like, all of this stuff was pouring out of me and into my work. And the creative process itself made me realize, like, I do have something to say, and these ideas matter. And then I eventually got the confidence to share them.
Yeah.
So I think my work has become a little bit, like, more complex over the years too, just because I have the confidence to use my work to express my, like, you know, my core values or my vulnerabilities or all those things that we're scared to express.
Yeah. The, early on you said you had talked about maybe the first question or the question that you got back from your audience was on style.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you chose to use the word voice. And I don't know if you've heard Tim Goodman say this, but I talk about it all the time in the podcast. I'm like, that's it. And he talked about how, don't be so concerned about how you say it. Concern yourself about what you're going to say, because that will color. To me, I think of it like form follows function. What's mm-hmm. the function of what you're trying to say? And that will influence how you're going to say it, and let that lead the way. And so I feel like voice kind of speaks to that. That was a pun on accident, but, how did you as a person, because I think of, I'm just going to explain a little bit more. I wish I could say this in a nutshell, but I can't. I think about how.
You, Andy.
All right, I'm trying. I don't know who I am, but I feel like one of the things I've realized over time making stuff for an audience is that they use my work as shorthand for their identity. Like, we do that with creative stuff. Of saying, I don't know how to explain who I am, but it's that art. That band, it's that, and it's people that don't spend their lives making art, either because they don't want to or they don't have time. We're like doing the work for them. I feel like that's part of the service. And I wonder if, how do you, because I went through that process. Not, I haven't gone through it, but I've like started to develop, these are my buckets, that this is what I'm about. And there's a few different ones, like neurodiversity is one for me that I think about all the time. It means something to me. It's a hill that I will die on. How did you determine some of those things? Because I think a lot of people that know you, if I said Lisa Congdon, I feel like all of your fans would say, if I said, what is she about? They would say this,
right,
this, and they know. Yeah. How do you feel like you came about knowing what your palette is in that kind of way?
Yeah. I mean, I think personal experience, everything I talk about and feel passionately about is something I've experienced personally. And I do think that if you try to get on a platform and make art about or speak about something you don't have personal experience with, it's going to fall flat anyway. Not just for your audience, but for you. And I think, fortunately, most people don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately, we all sort of talk about things that we've personally struggled with or overcome, right? Or are in the process of overcoming. And that's definitely true for me. So most of the stuff I talk about online is stuff that I either struggled with a lot when I was a younger woman.
Yeah.
In a world that is, that often, where women don't feel they have a voice or, living their life differently than how they want to because they're afraid.
Mm.
And also what I continue to work on or what I, you and I are both pretty spiritual people. And so this idea of sort of having these awakenings periodically where we figure something out and it fills us up. Right. And that is often the basis for what I'm talking about or making work about. I'll have some big aha moment or a series of moments, or I'll read something that just blows my mind, or I'll see some piece of art and then I'll dig into it. And I realize that the artist was making it because they were going through this thing that was super similar to something I went through. And I understand that's why I was drawn to that. Or I'll read a poem that, blows my mind or whatever. And those are the moments that I think drive a lot of the work that I make. Or I'll hear somebody talk about something, or I'll, I carry around a notebook. So I'm constantly writing things down that I hear or that I think or that occur to me. When I don't have my notebook, I have my phone, the notes on my phone, if I ever lost them.
Yeah,
because I still go back
dense.
To them.
Yeah.
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 So I don't just think those things. I write them down and then I start thinking about what could I do with this idea? What could I make? What piece of art can I make? And sometimes the art has those actual words in it.
Sure.
And sometimes it doesn't. It's just representational and symbolic.
Yep. It also sounds like you're saying experiences, but also doing the inner work and the personal development on a personal level goes hand in hand with
learning. You can't develop your voice without without exploration. And Sean Quells, who I interview in the book, talks about developing your vocabulary. And I love that. And when he said that, I was like, yes, you can't have a voice. When you learn another language, and that's I'm going to talk about this tonight too. Learning a language is very similar to developing your artistic skill, because you have to get to the point where you develop fluency and then things start to flow for you. But until you get to that point, there's a struggle, right? And you have to be in the struggle. The struggle never really goes away. It just
gets
easier.
Good.
So you have
love
to be, in the beginning, you have to, that's what separates those of us who have made professional careers out of, and or people who just make art all the time from the people who think about it but don't do it, is we have gotten really good at just sitting in the fear, right? And so, but part of coming up with ideas and, a lot of times one of the questions I get is how do you know what to draw? How do you come up with these ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And it's always something I read, a movie I saw, a podcast I listened to, a class I took, some rabbit hole I went down on the internet.
Yeah.
that was inspiring to me. I also go down rabbit holes that have zero relationship to my artwork, yeah. like true crime rabbit holes. So like not everything I'm obsessed with ends up in my artwork, but like a lot of it does. And that's part of being an artist, is like always expanding your mind and being open to new ideas and learning and reading and listening and watching and being observant and being open and like literally having binoculars on all of the time. And that's what I think I both struggle with as somebody who works a lot, right? Finding the time to do all those things. And also the thing that's sort of helped my work progress is that I have a certain level of openness and to learning and reading and absorbing things from the outside world.
Yeah. I just want to mark this because it is blowing my mind. That idea of, flow state in your work is equal to fluency in a language. Like you can't, like if you're thinking about talking because you don't know the words enough, you can't get into a good conversation where it's flowing. Right.
Right.
And the same goes for your medium of choice or that's amazing.
Yes. Yeah, that was an analogy that I thought of while I was writing this book. And I think some of it came from, I think I had recommended to you a few years ago, this book Wired to Create.
Uh-huh.
And, yep. I quote the authors of that book. It's a research book on creativity. And they talk about like all of these things that influence, you know, they've studied creative people or highly creative people for a long time. And I don't just mean artists. I mean, like, you know, scientists amazing scientists. Like they just released the MacArthur Genius Awards yesterday, the names of those people. And like half of them are scientists because like science is science, but it also like to even allow yourself to think that something is possible in science requires a lot of creative thinking, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Scientists are some of the most creative people. Yeah. And so just this idea that like, I don't know, that you have to get to this place where, you know, you have mastery of something. And the authors of that book talk about mastery as a really important component of creativity, because once you've mastered the technical aspects of something like a language or artistic skill
or an instrument or whatever,
you can focus on all the other things that then make it yours, right? Mm-hmm. Like you learn how the technical skill of drawing or painting, but then you can focus on composition and color and like the weirdness, you know? That's why in art school, they make you take these like very rote classes around like how to draw things from perspective. I mean, I never took those classes because I'm self-taught, but I'm presuming that's why they do that, right? Because then once you have those things down, then you're sort of freed up to make that stuff your own or choose to use the parts of it that you enjoy.
Yeah. You know. Did you, is that Rex Jung? Do you know? The Wired to Create?
No, it's Kaufman and Gregoire are the last names of the authors. Yeah.
Okay. Rex Jung does a bunch of neuroscience around creativity.
Yeah.
I have talks about openness to experience as well.
Yeah. I haven't read that book. Wired to Create was one of my go-to books, and they're quoted a few times in Fine Artistic Voice. And I highly recommend, I mean, it's more of an academic book,
sure,
but it's actually written in a way that's really easy to understand. And for anyone who's interested in like creativity research, I highly recommend it.
I want to go to openness to experience in a second, but, before I do, this is just a random tangent. Did you have you seen the movie Arrival?
Remind me.
What's her name? Camera guys, chime in. Amy Adams. They didn't give that to me. I got it myself.
Tell me the premise.
Okay,
I see so many movies, and I'm not necessarily a movie.
Is this a spoiler? Have you seen it? Yeah. Okay. Spoiler alert. Just fast forward this like 15 seconds if you don't want to know. But the movie's been out for ages, so it's your fault. Anyway. And I won't spoil it for you.
No. I've probably seen it, but I just need you to remind me.
It's about aliens. They come down in these giant sphere things, like big, like cylinder-like spaceships. And she's like a linguistics expert, and she's trying to uncode.
Yes, I have seen it.
Yeah, and I love this because it's based in the science that, like, people that can't talk, it affects their ability to think. So if you don't know any language, your brain doesn't work the same as people that know languages. And then every language you learn changes the way that your brain looks, works. It changes your ability to think. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, that it just I'm inspired by that idea of like when you learn an instrument or a medium or whatever, it's like learning a new language. And all of a sudden, you're able to excavate things out of yourself that you couldn't exercise without making. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Yeah. Like my podcast was like that to me. Like there was something about doing the podcast that made me realize so much stuff about myself that I didn't know. It changed. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like unlock different parts of my brain.
Well, sure. Cause you're also in therapy with yourself. You're true. Talking, you're talking to a microphone
yeah, that's right.
about, you know, instead of somebody sitting on a couch. But I think that's why a lot of times when we write or when we talk to people about what we're going through, we have these moments where, I mean, I think even just in the last 2 days that we've been hanging out, I've had like three, like, oh my God moments,
yeah,
like talking about this stuff that you and I are both passionate about.
Yeah.
And like, you've said something, and I'm like, oh my God, that's you know, and that is like, it brings you so much further along in your process when you're able to talk about it and express it. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about openness to experience. Yeah. Because I think it kind of, I mean, it does what it says on the tin kind of thing. Like it is kind of what that phrase mm-hmm. means, what it says, but can you talk a little bit about, what that means in terms of the ideas of the book?
Sure. So it comes up in the book, mostly talking about like, in the last chapter, I talk about like all the sort of practical things you can do to sort of not, you can't rush finding your voice, but maybe speed up the process. There are definitely things you can do. And
you can make intentional progress.
Right, right. And some of them are like, make art every day. They're sort of like these things that you can cross off, right? But then some of them are a little bit more out there, you know, mm-hmm. like more sort of mindset changes. And one of them is openness to experience. There's another one that follows that says think like a beginner. But the openness to experience really was one of those things that in my research for the book I learned was so critically important. And that, for example, you know, if you are, so research says that is one of the most, I say this like, it's like one of the top predictors mm-hmm. of creative achievement is openness to experience. So so what does that mean? It means being open to new solutions and to problems for sure. And that is going to enhance innovation, but it's also things that you wouldn't necessarily imagine. Like, for example, the ability to sit with somebody who's experiencing deep emotional pain, which most of us want to run away from, even if we love the person, right? Like it's so uncomfortable to be with somebody when they're upset grieving about something and grieving. Like that is openness to experience. If you can just get yourself to be with someone's discomfort, which is sometimes harder than being with our own, right?
True, yes.
Or if you find yourself having have you ever walked into a museum and just felt overcome with emotion, like you wanted to cry if you were like seeing a piece of art or a collection of art that just moved you?
I don't have that.
Do you have it with
I have what movies?
Music?
Music does
okay.
it to me, yes.
So for everybody, it's different.
Yep.
For me, it's usually more visual, but I also have that same experience with music, right?
Yep.
Or with being in nature. I went to the Grand Canyon for the first time by myself on a solo road trip when I was in my 30s. And when I was actually, it was sort of at the beginning of my creative journey. And I was so overcome with emotion when I saw it for the first time. And I was like in this national park surrounded by tourists and I couldn't stop crying. That is openness to experience, right? Like that if you can allow yourself to sort of be in, and it's just, so it's vulnerability basically, that if you can tap into that, it allows your brain to sort of like absorb all of these things that then influence sort of what you're making work about or this sense of possibility. So a lot of times we have ideas about things we want to make and yet we say, well, that's not possible. Mm. Our brain has already decided that something isn't possible. We always think in terms of limitations versus what's possible. And so, you know, openness to experience requires having a beginner mind, right? Where you're actually, and this is such hard work. I feel like this is one of the hardest things to do is actually put yourself in the place of somebody who doesn't have the answers, even if you are considered an expert in that thing.
Yeah. Yep.
So, and as you know, like you and I are both people who people look up to be experts in creativity. And oftentimes I get questions and I'm like, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
and that's actually true because, I think it's like important to acknowledge when we don't actually know the answers, or even if we do, that maybe there's the possibility that there's a different answer or a different solution. And, I feel like as a creative person, it's like the more I can get myself into this beginner mind or openness to possibility, the better my work becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are all kinds of practical things you can follow that up with. Like one of the things I'm working on right now is like a workshop on like ideation and idea generation. And like when you have an assignment as a professional artist and you want to like explode out the best ideas for the project, for the client, or maybe even for your own personal work, like how do you go about that? So,
what are the, can you talk about that a little
well,
bit?
Well, I am a like huge fan of brainstorming and mind mapping. It's been transformational in my own creative practice and in just sort of like making big changes in my life. But I have so much to learn about that and how to do it better. So that's one of the things I'm really wanting to learn more about.
I have a few different directions there, but
Can
you just tell me, because you were talking about mind mapping last night and I was really interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
What does that process look for like for you? Just if I wanted to do what, when would you use that? What, you know, what problems are you trying to solve or what are you trying to explore and how do you go about doing it?
Well, for me, and again, I think there's probably a lot of ways to do it.
I know you're not, you don't have to be an expert to talk on it.
I know. Just tell, it's so funny.
You're an expert compared to me.
My
I own nothing.
Former editor was like, Lisa, don't be afraid to be authoritative. And I'm like, I still struggle. I'm so much more authoritative than I've ever been. But like, I still sometimes I'm like, especially with things that I don't have a ton of experience with. And mind mapping is something I talk about a lot, but I'm not like, there are people who are like professional mind mappers.
Sure.
But anyways, you start with like the problem or the idea or even just one word. And you, it, for me, it's a very visual process, but you write the thing, you draw a circle around it, and then you make a web, right? And you sort of explode out that thing. And it depends on the question or the topic, but you kind of, and then say you're basically drawing a web. And so then there's a line from the circle and then that explodes out to another circle. And then from there, so it's a way to sort of brainstorm possibilities for anything.
Mm.
And I know I'm being super general.
No,
but,
it's fine. I'm just interested.
When
do you, what prompts you doing one?
Anything from like, I'm bored with my routine. Like, how can I break up my routine to, I get an assignment from an art director and I'm stumped about ideas or I don't like any of the ideas they've given me.
Yeah.
I might do a brainstorming around that uses that kind of visual mind mapping. Any kind of like problem solving.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, sometimes I'm using it all the time. Sometimes I don't use it for months. So
that's super interesting. When you're talking about openness to experience it, I saw like a parallel to something I've tried to explore on the podcast, but it gave me a bunch of new layers to it. This idea of the creative people that I look up to most seem to be able to acquire new tastes. So just like, you know, I used to not like IPAs and whiskey and now I do, but it was because the first time I tasted them, I wasn't judgmental about them.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of, is that kind of a similar, is there a parallel there? Acquired taste to openness to experience? Like when you're not judging a thing as like, oh, I already know what this is going to be.
Yeah. And it's tricky because, well, you and I talk about this a lot just in our friendship, but like this idea of taste, right? That there's just sort of these things that we're attracted to and that these things that, you know, it's like actually even in the formation of your artistic voice, part of what helps you form that is like you're consuming visual information constantly and you're filtering all of it as I either like that or I'm drawn to that or that is ugly. And we don't even necessarily know why we think those things. I mean, I definitely, as you and I both agree, there are reasons why you like and don't like things and you have to unpack that if you're interested in it. But, and so honoring that you like or don't like certain things visually is important. You don't have to force yourself necessarily to be a different kind of creative person. But I do also think that when you have a certain level of openness to experience, you're going to be less judgmental about other people's creative paths, even though they might be different than yours. Even though you might not, I mean, there's so many artists out there whose work I would never hang in my house.
Yeah.
But I have so much respect for them as creative people and thinkers and forces in the world. Right.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate their work for what it is. It's just not my style. And so there's, that's one factor. And then another is like when you are open to seeing things differently, I do think it changes your work.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that, that it can make your work different or better to be open to something that, as you say, is like trying a food that, you know, and discovering you actually like it.
Uh-huh.
I was so averse to digital drawing forever. Like I so judgy about people who I was like, I only made vector work when I had to for a client. And I was like all about like paper and gouache and, ink. And then I got really bad tendonitis in my arm. And from, because part of being an illustrator is I was making that stuff by hand. And then I was like taking, scanning it, putting it in Photoshop and manipulating it. And I was spending so much time on my trackpad and all these like bad ergonomic situations to try to like get my work ready for print. And my doctor was like, there's got to be a different way to do this. Right. And so I got an iPad and started just, and it's sped up my process so much that I don't spend as much time in Photoshop. And I'm also like, you know, can undo things so quickly. And so I'm just not spending as much time drawing,
yeah,
but I'm also drawing more. And now I've figured out a way to make my digital drawings look like paintings. So sometimes people can't even tell the difference.
Yeah.
And so that's like, I finally became open actually out of necessity to having to use this tool, which I was so averse to. And now I feel like it's transformed my work in a million positive ways. And I, my life and my work have changed because of the iPad in a way that like, I mean, of course I'm taking a sabbatical next year and the first thing I want to do is start painting with paints again and like make big paintings. Like I miss that other thing, but I also can appreciate how much my openness to this new way of doing things had consequences that I could never have imagined. And imagine if I had just, shut myself off to that, you know. I was having a conversation the other day with a friend who is a fine artist. She lives in Seattle and she has a mentor who's a pretty well-known painter. And she was talking about how he is super old school, right? Like he's in his 70s. And she's like, have you ever thought about doing this? Have you ever thought about doing this? And he's like, no, I don't do that. No, I don't do that. And she's like, well, would you like to do that? And he said, oh yes, but I can't, I don't. And I feel like artists in our generation and sort of like we kind of came of age in this world where doing things many different ways and using different tools became acceptable. You didn't just have to paint. You didn't just have to draw digitally. You could be a graphic designer and an illustrator. You could be a surface designer and a fine artist. Like you could do what everything. And there used to be all these rules that said, you can't, you know. And I think inherently we are more open to artists working in whatever way makes them happy, and that doesn't necessarily take the value out of their work. And so I feel like it's an amazing time to be an artist because we have all these tools available to us that, you know, in generations before ours, you know, with the exception of maybe David Hockney, who is like, you know, he's one of the most open older guys I've ever, you know, I don't know him personally, obviously, but like, you know, experienced. And, but you know, we're so lucky, you know?
Absolutely. Your story about tendonitis, is that what it was? It reminds me of, like sometimes, like when you're reading about story structure, they say that rarely does the hero say yes to the journey willingly, and almost always the journey forces itself on them. And so like, that's a good situation of like, you were forced to be open, or you're at least forced to reevaluate what you were doing.
Well, and I think when hard things happen, whether like there's sickness or illness or an injury or the death of someone you love or whatever, like those are the moments where actually you often have the most clarity about what matters and what's important
to
you.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I don't actually think you can develop skill or taste or any of those things without struggle.
That, and actually, I think the really interesting thing there is, although you were forced to with this obstacle, maybe the real mental gymnastics that's necessary is, what do you do when you're in the face of an obstacle? Because this happens to me all the time, right? Like, a client will put me in a circumstance where I'm like pissed and I'm having a tantrum with my agent, and I'm like, I can't, why do they do that? Like, I don't have, like, they just ruined the friggin' thing. And now I only have this much time to do it. And often it's in those little like tight spots, mm-hmm. where all of a sudden I have to be like, well, what matters? How do I make this good? And one other thing I think it does is it forces you into making choices in your taste rather than your skill, or rather than, you know, trial and error over long, you know, being whatever. It makes you get to what could I do in 2 hours that I still think is good.
Mm-hmm. And it and forces still makes me. Them happy.
Yeah, yeah, it still makes them happy. And I think my point is, there's a bunch of people that when they get tendonitis, or when they are forced, or they come to an obstacle, that they shut down as, well, I can't possibly, like, it reminds me that there's a Stoic principle that says the obstacle is the way. Like, the obstacle is the thing.
100%.
Yeah, that makes, yeah, exactly. Can you, is that like connected to, mm-hmm. why do you say that? Because I don't want to
Well, because I think for the same reason that I said what I just said, which is like, I don't think life is hard. Like, just hard stuff happens.
You can swear.
Every single day.
By the way, hard shit happens.
Hard shit happens. And one of the things that I learned in my path was, so I used to be one of those people who felt like she had no agency. And so something bad would happen and I would either wallow in self-pity, or I would, and simultaneously not do anything to change the situation. And then I finally woke up and, you know, was like, oh, wait a second. I have, you know, what if I tried on a different hat and decided that I actually, there was the possibility that I could create a life that was happy and where I wasn't constantly feeling like a victim. Mm. And certainly there are situations where I still feel like a victim, like somebody, like a client does something that really pisses me off.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so then it's always like, okay, in those moments, which are the harder moments, I think we're less motivated to make good work or do good in the world, or less inspired to be a better person when we're not confronted with struggle. Like, what would be the point? You could just, if everything was easy all the time, you'd just be sliding along doing your thing.
Yeah.
And so everybody experiences hardship and pain. I guess it's sort of like how you choose to use that to sort of move and grow on your path versus how you're allowing it to keep you stuck as an excuse to keep you stuck. And we all know not necessarily, I think, I don't want to make this too binary. There's not like just two kinds of people in the world.
No.
One who use obstacles and those who use them as an excuse. Crushed by them. I think there's definitely middle ground. And one of the things that I've learned in my 51 years is that things are not always black and white. So, but I do think that those are two sort of general categories. And I always remind myself that I have the choice to not necessarily escape pain, but use that pain to be a better person,
yeah.
or a better artist, or a better whatever, whatever that means, whatever better means, yeah. I don't even know.
One thing I just want to add to that, because I think it's, it reminds me of, again, building on that Stoic principle, building on openness to experience. One of the, I think we're all open to things that seem good. Like, almost everybody would be open to winning the lottery. Like, we're like, yeah, great. That sounds, I'll take that. And there's a Stoic idea of non-judgment, like reserving your judgment to later on all things, because they say that, you know, lots of people's lives have been ruined by winning the lottery. Lots of people's lives have been made by losing their job. And so that approach to, I think that,
not labeling things as good or bad. That's a very sort of Buddhist principle too.
True.
So like that experiences are just experiences, and it's how you show up for them. that matters.
That's how you get open. Yeah. I get, of course, I'm going to like sit, and everybody knows that listens to this show knows that the most esoteric, abstract idea of this whole thing is the one that I camped out at most. Openness to experience. I could just keep thinking about that. I wanted to ask you, out of everything you learn in this book, what is something that you think is, if you could only tell people one thing from the book that makes a difference in your journey on finding your voice, what would it be?
Show up and do the work. I think I talk about this in the book. There, you know, there's this notion that, especially now in this day and age, like so many amazing artists and designers, you know, are online and we're all seeing like their finished work. Mm-hmm. And I think we imagine that, that they were as talented and prolific and confident, you know, from the day they started making art to, you know, nobody sees what's underneath all of that. And every one of your heroes has struggled and continues to struggle. Every one of your heroes experiences the same feelings of insecurity about their work that you do. And that fact should actually, in my opinion, is like the most hopeful thing, because it's like finding your voice isn't this experience that's reserved for a few innately talented people. It's really something that if you show up and you're disciplined enough to keep showing up and working through your frustration or, you know, whatever, you know, gap there is between your skills and your taste or, you know, all of the stuff that is hard. If you show up for that and continue at it, you'll find it. You will. It might take you longer than somebody else and it might take somebody else longer than you. But if you continue to show up and make a concerted effort to sort of learn and grow and get better at whatever it is you want to get better at, no matter whether you're a musician or a writer or a visual artist, if you keep showing up, you can't do something every day and not get better at it and not find your own niche in that thing.
Yep.
And that's, you know, I always say like, if I could condense the book into one sentence, it would just like be, keep making art or show up and do the work, because I think people want to avoid it. They think it's some magic pill they can take that all of a sudden they're going to wake up and, but no, unfortunately you just have to like make a lot of fucking art.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
That's it.
It seems like a huge,
and that's both like overwhelming to think about, but it's also like kind of a relief. Like it's not magic. It's just work.
Yes.
So everyone who chooses to show up and
put
do
in
the work,
time,
and we'll get there.
A huge theme that shows up in the book, I feel like, is quantity leads to quality. Like that's the kind of, if you just keep making stuff, and I've said this a bunch of times, if you're not making piles of work, you're doing it wrong. Like if you're not, if that's not, and one of the things I feel like musicians more than anything, I don't know why, this is just me being judgmental about musicians. I have a lot of musician friends. I feel like they don't make enough songs. Like just like it makes shitty demos, just make tons of shit. And if you do that, you can cut out all of the stuff that sucks and lean into the other stuff. But if you're not making stuff, you're not really progressing.
That's right. Or you're not going to discover those like, you know, I mean, when I did that Experiments in Blue project in 2016, where I was like mostly painting in blue for the entire year.
Which, by the way, I said, I think you started blue as a cultural thing, a cultural moment. I feel that's true, whether you're going to take it or not. But
not
my whole kitchen
it.
Is blue. And I think it's because my wife was like obsessed. Loving your work and just like blue. It's just,
Well, I like blue too. And actually, my house is mostly blue too, because I decorated around that year when we moved to Portland. But anyways, like I think that sort of like the constraints of that and the, you know, like forced me to, you know, the production every day forced me to make a lot of crap. Like half the stuff in that project, I can't even look at. I couldn't even put it on a screen in my PowerPoint presentation. Yeah. But like there were three or four things in that entire year that were game changers for me in terms of the direction of my work and discoveries I made. And, that is way more, you know, like the cumulative value of the entire year's work is important, but it's not because everything I did was successful.
No. I love that you said that, because all of my long-term projects, like Nod that we've talked about, like I made a character every weekday for a year. Yeah. And at the end of it, I feel like there were four characters I made that have stayed in my work. And part of me is like, man, that's all that came from that. But it's, It's huge. Those little things that, compound
one
over time.
One last story on that topic. I was traveling around. This is way before I started, around the time I started making art. Early 2000s. I went to Thailand with a friend, and she was a professional photographer. And I was getting into photography. In fact, that could easily have been my path if I hadn't discovered painting and drawing. And so I had a Holga, which is like this... Yeah. Like plastic Russian camera that I taped up. Yeah. And then I had my I didn't have a digital camera yet because I had a film camera because digital photography was just kind of like those cameras were too expensive at the time. And so I had a DS, not a digital, but a
SLR.
SLR. Yeah. Yeah. And I took so many photos and just we went to the most beautiful places and I was so excited to come back and take my film in to be developed. And I remember spending like what at the time seemed like so much money to get these photos, rolls and rolls of photos developed. We were there for like 3 weeks. And I picked them up and I looked at I got in my car and I couldn't wait. And I just started looking at them. And I was so overwhelmed with disappointment because literally out of every roll, maybe one photo was really good. And so I called Sue and my friend, who's the professional photographer, and I think I was crying. And she was like, Lisa, are you kidding? That's amazing. Like total change. She's like, that you got one really good photo out of each roll. Like that is amazing. I wanted them all to be amazing.
Yeah.
And that was like, that was one of those mind blowing moments for me. Cause I repeat that story a lot.
Yeah. I love
because, it. Because, here was this experienced person being like, no, that's amazing. And then of course, over time I go back and I was like way more than one in each roll was amazing. It's just that, you know, again, my taste level versus my skill level at the time, there was a gap there. And I realized that there were probably more than one in each role that were really good, but I had such high expectations that I was very disappointed. But that's such a great lesson, right? Like you have to turn out a volume of crap to get the one diamond.
Yeah, Seth Godin says that the people that have good ideas have tons of bad ideas.
Yeah.
I think that's totally true. Well, thank you for doing this. Yeah. This is one of my favorite conversations. I love talking to you because I feel like you and I are both spiritual people that like mystical side of life. And, you know, and then yet when it comes to creativity, something that most people see as mystical and mysterious, we get very pragmatic and like,
here's how you do it.
Yeah. Like what? It's so weird. But there's something about that is just super refreshing to me. So thank you so much.
Thanks
for
having me. This was super fun.
Lisa, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks for coming out to Columbus and doing the event and hanging out. We had dinner. We did the interview. We hung out. We did the talks together. We had the most tremendous time putting on this event together. And it was just, I've met Lisa a handful of times and I would have said we were already friends, but now I feel like we're really good friends. And it was just a blast hanging out with you. And thanks for being on the show again. Thanks for all of the work that you do for creative people. It has such a tremendous impact. And I'm so glad to, get to work alongside you on this mission, if you will. Thanks again, Lisa. Go check out her new book, Find Your Artistic Voice. I think it's going to have a big impact on your creative career. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Thanks to Alex Sugg for our soundtrack. Thanks to Chris Graham for audio assistance of Chris Graham Mastering and the Six Figure Home Studio podcast. If you're in the audio space trying to make a living, you should go check that out. Thanks to all of you for listening for 5 years. And until next week, stay pepped up.